the Moment Broadcast Center. This is Take Two. May Martinez. Even before the pandemic, filing for unemployment was a tricky river to try and cross. Now, with so many people needing help, it can feel like you're drowning after just taking one step. Well, we've read all the instructions and will help you get to the other side with cash on the way. Plus, USC's Black Student Assembly wants the university to reimagine its public safety department to finally confront systemic racism on campus. It's ahead on Take Two. From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take Two. I'm A. Martinez. Coming up on the show, as conversations over racial inequality continue across the country, students at the University of Southern California are calling for anti-racism reforms on their campus. We'll hear from one of the students leading those calls. That's ahead in about 30 minutes. But we're going to start with the latest on the state's coronavirus response following news that California top state health official Dr. Sonia Angel is leaving her job. In a letter to her staff, Dr. Angel thanked her colleagues for their work, but did not give a specific reason for her departure. And during today's news briefing, Governor Gavin Newsom was pressed about Dr. Angel's resignation.
She resigned. She wrote a resignation letter, and I accepted her resignation. We're all accountable in our respective roles for what happens underneath us. I don't want to err any more than that.
The resignation also comes after health officials recently announced an undercount of coronavirus cases due to technical issues with CalReady. That's the state's electronic lab reporting system. For more, let's talk to Sacramento Bee politics reporter Sophia Bolag, who's been covering this story. Sophia, welcome back to Take Two.
Thanks for having me.
Now, we just heard from Governor Newsom, who provided an update on Dr. Angel's resignation. But before we get into that, can you take us back to last night when Dr. Angel announced that she was leaving her job? How did we hear about this, and did it come as a surprise?
Yes, it was a pretty abrupt announcement. Late yesterday evening, the Health and Human Services Agency, which is the agency that oversees the California Department of Public Health, which is the department that Angel runs or ran, announced that she was leaving her post effective immediately. In addition to running the public health department, she also served as the state's public health officer. And so the announcement last night was that she would be leaving both of those posts immediately and that two other women would be appointed to replace her in the interim. But yes, it was a surprise. There was no advance notice that this was going to be happening.
Now, it looks and sounds and feels like a resignation, but was it really a resignation?
Yeah, so Newsom was asked about this a number of times just about half an hour ago during his press conference, and he really refused to give any specifics or any details, saying that he didn't want to discuss personnel issues publicly. But he did say that she resigned and that she submitted a resignation letter to him. He was specifically asked whether he asked her to resign, and he did not answer that question. And he also didn't answer any questions about what led to her resignation.
Now, what was her specific role and how long has she been on the job?
So Newsom appointed Dr. Angel to her positions late last year, back in September, and she assumed those roles in October. And essentially, she has been one of the top officials working with Newsom on the state's coronavirus response. She leads the most prominent department, the Department of Public Health, which has been, you know, really, really leading the way on issuing guidances for businesses, but also just for regular people. The Department of Public Health put out the mask mandates that we've all had to comply with. So her role has really been instrumental in a lot of the decisions that the Newsom administration has made to combat the virus.
And this job has had a little bit of a history of people leaving, right? Because she replaced someone that also resigned.
Yeah, and you know, prior to the coronavirus, I'm not sure exactly off the top of my head what all of the previous reasons were. But certainly her resignation comes rather abruptly. She hadn't been in the job long. And, you know, that we are about 5 months into the pandemic, which obviously has been a major crisis that she's been dealing with, and she's leaving really right in the middle of it.
Well, I'm talking about Dr. Charity Dean. She also served as assistant director, right?
Yes. Dr. Dean resigned a couple of months ago. That was sort of less abrupt. She announced that she would be leaving that job, I believe, at the beginning of June, and then she actually left at the start of July. She also did not give a reason, and the Newsom administration has not answered questions about why she left. She was working very closely she co-chaired Newsom's testing task force, so that was probably the most prominent aspect of the state's response that she worked on. But yes, this is now with Dean having resigned and Angel resigning as well. This is the second really high-profile public health resignation that we've seen during this pandemic.
Yeah, never a good time for a resignation during a pandemic. I'm wondering what kind of impact might all this shuffling around have on the state's coronavirus response?
Well, Newsom today tried to assure everyone that that there are good people replacing her and that the state's response will continue and continues to be, aggressive in combating the virus. But it's really unclear at this point, since it is such recent news, how Angel's departure is going to affect the Newsom administration's response.
Because now all of this comes amid the recent news about there's actually been an undercount of statewide coronavirus cases. That's because of the electronic lab reporting system called CalReady has been experiencing technical issues. What do we know about that problem, and did the state announce any progress in resolving it?
Yeah, so essentially back in late July, public health departments at the county level began noticing that they were getting really a much smaller volume of coronavirus case data than they were expecting. And it seems it took a bit of time to, reach the California Department of Public Health, and perhaps even longer to reach Newsom and his Health and Human Services Secretary, Dr. Mark Galli, who only found out about the problem on Monday. Last Monday. But essentially, a series of technical errors and human errors have blocked many, many cases. Those are either positive or negative test results from reaching the state's database. And essentially, that's meant that counties didn't know for weeks how many people in their communities were testing positive, or who the people, who many of the people had tested positive were, so they weren't able to contact them. And that really impeded county's efforts to respond to the virus and conduct contact tracing. So at this point, Dr. Galli announced today that the state has worked through the backlog of cases. They've addressed the technical issues that were preventing this data from going through. They've processed at the state level those cases that were backlogged. It was nearly 300,000 cases. And now it's up to the counties to finish processing that data. And Dr. Galli and Governor Newsom say that the data will be updated in the next few days.
That's Sophia Boleg, California politics reporter for the Sacramento Bee. Sophia, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
All right, moving on. President Trump issued an executive action on Saturday, and he extended what the federal government contributes to unemployment benefits. But instead of the $600 each week that people had been getting previously, it'll now be $400 each week, and the states will have to fund 25% of that. It's the latest saga as lawmakers in D.C. try to continue the financial lifeline it's been giving to millions of Americans. But the thing is, it can get really confusing. And we have an effort to really help Angelenos navigate all of the complicated changes going on right now. LAist Associate Editor Lisa Brenner has been working very hard on our newsroom's How to New LA series. The latest addition to this series is a comprehensive guide on one of the most frequently asked questions that we've been getting from our listeners and readers. careers, and that's how to successfully apply for and get unemployment benefits in California. And it is a lot. Hey, Lisa.
Hi.
All right, Lisa. So what did you learn about all this?
Like just about everything else for Angelenos right now, the rules of unemployment have changed and then changed again and will likely change again. This has been an extremely stressful time for millions of Californians. People are getting a lot less in unemployment benefits, and hundreds of thousands of them are still waiting on payments. People are trying to figure out the system that was somewhat inscrutable to begin with. So we put together this guide with all of sorts of practical tips and step-by-step advice, whether you're filing for the first time or troubleshooting an existing claim.
All right. Now, Lisa, we keep hearing all about these delays, which is really upsetting to the people in limbo, and it's completely understandable, too. Why are there so many delays?
The state's Employment Development Department, you hear it just called EDD a lot, recently said that a few hundred thousand claims were stuck in some sort of departmental limbo, just waiting for resolution that they hoped would be sorted out by September. But the majority of the delays were because not all of the necessary steps had been completed. So, you know, this system can be absurdly difficult to navigate. And if something does go wrong or a step gets overlooked, it's nearly impossible to speak to an actual human person and get it resolved quickly. So that's another reason we put this guide together, to help people find the steps a little easier and hopefully minimize some of the delays in getting paid.
All right. So let's start with the end game. I'm out of work. My unemployment application is approved. How much can I expect to get paid right now?
At the moment, the best case scenario is $450 a week, but it could be $40 a week, possibly something in between. There is essentially a three-part process for acquiring unemployment. You've got to register, filing, certifying. Registering is setting up an account. Filing is providing personal details and work history. Certifying is checking in every 2 weeks with EDD to say that you are still unemployed and eligible. Certifying is where some things go wrong. Certifying is very important. If you don't do it, they will stop sending you money. So you can manage the entire benefit process online, over the phone, by mail, even with a fax machine. Wow. But EDD recommends online if possible.
All right. So who is eligible? What are some of the reasons someone can file for unemployment?
It could be health reasons or work reasons right now. You can file because of termination, cut hours, unpaid leave or furlough. You've got quarantine or symptoms, diagnosis. You're providing care for somebody in your household. And in some cases, even missing or quitting work to be at home with your children while schools are closed. And there are other reasons.
How long do the benefits last?
We really wanted to give people a simple answer on this, but it's variable. The pandemic program was set up to 46 weeks through the end of December. State unemployment's typically only 26 weeks, but these are not typical times. So now there's something called the pandemic emergency unemployment compensation, which is another 13 weeks. And if you use all of that, you might qualify for a different 20-week extension. And all of the EDD guidance says that that will be applied automatically.
All right. Now let's talk about that $600. So that went away and it was not extended by Congress. So what does the president's weekend executive order mean for these additional payments?
That's not clear exactly what's going to happen. The executive order issued on Saturday mentions $400, not $600, but it's not a clean extension of what existed. It also wouldn't just be federal money. States would have to help fund it. So the timeline, it really isn't clear. There are a lot of details that have to be worked out. And prior to the order, California lawmakers were considering how they could cover that $600 hole with state funds. The state proposal is in early stages. But for the time being, Californians are back to receiving weekly benefits based solely on past income or wages. So that means $167 to $450 a week if your claim is processed through the pandemic-specific program, or $40 a week to $450 a week if your claim is processed through regular state unemployment. However it shakes out, the situation right now is that that extra money is gone. So it's even more crucial that the money people are eligible for is actually making it to them. One silver lining is that if the president's plan does move forward, people would get that extra $400 retroactively.
We're talking about how to maneuver through unemployment with LAist Associate Editor Lisa Brenner. It's part of our How to New LA series. All right, now, can you explain the difference between regular state unemployment and the pandemic-specific program, and who's eligible for what?
Right. When you file a claim with EDD on the website, you access something called the Benefit Programs Portal, and that handles claims for both. But don't panic if you are not sure which one you qualify for, because you don't actually get to choose. And there's been some confusion over that, too. Applicants are asked the same set of questions about history and earnings. And then there is a new set of questions to determine eligibility for that. And the department figures out which program best fits your situation, and the paperwork is processed accordingly. The new program was created to get financial relief for self-employed people, people who wouldn't typically qualify for unemployment. And that could mean like business owners or gig workers, freelancers, independent contractors, people with a limited work history. And there's a longer list of people who qualify too.
All right. So where else can people get some answers?
This guide, the Unemployment Guide, is on LAIS. It's part of our How to New LA special project. And that whole project is a series of practical guides for navigating day-to-day life in LA, which, as you know, is changing almost minute by minute. So at laist.com/howtonewla with hyphens in there. From there, we also have links to all of the EDD FAQs, and there are a number of them. And people can also just ask us their questions directly. The reason that we know people are struggling with getting their unemployment benefits is because we've answered thousands and thousands of reader and listener questions since the pandemic took hold. And an outsized number of them have been about unemployment benefits.
Lisa, one last question. I mean, how did you figure all this out?
It wasn't easy. I did not sleep a lot. I read through a lot of the website, the EDD website, which is a little bit like chasing your tail through a labyrinth. I read through all of our newsroom reporting, everything that our economy and business reporter David Wagner has been covering. But ultimately, to figure out how this worked step by step, I just had to walk through the process as much of it as I could to really understand how detailed it was.
All right. That's LAIS Associate Editor Lisa Brenner. To read more of the How to New LA series, just go to our website, laist.com. That's laist.com. Lisa, thanks a lot.
Thanks, A.
All right, living on the beach in a house overlooking the Pacific sounds dreamy, but in a few decades, it could wind up being a nightmare. That's because if today you decide to buy land by the sea, it might become more sea than land. Find out why when Take Two continues. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC and the KPCC app. I'm E. Martinez. All right, let's now check in on Orange County. Cities in South County have seen cases of COVID-19 continue to rise. Meanwhile, all of the OC faces complications from the state's data reporting issues. Nick Gerda has been covering these issues. He's a reporter with a nonprofit news site, The Voice of OC. He joins us regularly for the OC Update. Nick, welcome back.
Great to be here. Hope you're doing well.
All right. Let's start with the latest news about COVID-19 in Orange County. What parts of the county are seeing increases in case numbers?
Yeah, so Santa Ana and Anaheim continue to have the highest numbers of new cases per capita. That's basically divided into the population in Orange County over the month of July from the numbers that have been reported so far. The virus has been hitting working class Latino communities especially hard. Many residents are essential workers like grocery clerks and warehouse distributors where physical distancing is very difficult in the workplace while they wrestle with trying to quarantine in overcrowded housing back home. Interestingly, cities in South Orange County saw the biggest percent growths in coronavirus cases within Orange County in the last month, according to testing data released by the county. And we looked into that and had a story on that today.
Yeah, so that's Lake Forest, Dana Point kind of region, right?
Exactly. And San Clemente as well.
San Clemente. Okay. So what have you heard from some of the city officials you've spoken to?
Yeah, so a couple of the mayors of the South County cities with the largest percent increases, Lake Forest and Dana Point, didn't get back to our messages, nor did Supervisor Lisa Bartlett, who represents South County. But we did speak with Laura Ferguson, the acting mayor of San Clemente, which had the third highest percent increase in July of cases out of all the cities in Orange County. And she attributed her city's increase to two things: more testing at a hospital in her city, as well as more people dining out and socializing. She says after people dine out, about. They often socialize along the boardwalk there and out and about in the city. I also talked with Santa Ana's mayor, Miguel Pulido. That's the most impacted city in terms of new cases per capita. And he said he's met families where the dad gets infected, goes home to quarantine, but can't physically distance himself from family members in overcrowded housing. He said he's heard that story over and over again. And then the entire family gets sick. So he's calling for more options for people to be able to quarantine in a hotel to help slow the virus's spread.
You know, Nick, last month we talked with the creators behind a viral video documenting resistance to wearing masks in Huntington Beach. That's a trend that Voice of OC is also reporting on. Do maskless pedestrians in parts of Orange County still seem to be prevalent?
So per reports, there are some residents who are walking around without masks in more crowded environments. South County has been a center for mass defiance, something that an epidemiologist told us is likely contributing to the worsening situation there. Huntington Beach has also been another high-profile area for mask resistance, including at protests, local businesses, and church services at the beach. County health officials, when we've asked about this, say it's unknown exactly why some cities are more affected than others, since there are so many factors at play in how a disease spreads. But they said the virus is more likely to spread in places where people aren't following safety measures as often, like face coverings and staying home and social distancing. And one of the county's top public health officials, Mark Millman, told us that COVID-19 transmission is widespread throughout the county, region, state, and nation, and that people should consider the risk to be everywhere.
Nick, I know someone who went to a very specific kind of store in Costa Mesa wearing a mask, and she was told when she walked in, you know, you don't have to wear one here.
There's been lots of stories like that. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, over the past few days, we've been hearing about data glitches causing California's backlog of up to 300,000 test results that have not been processed. That's created delays in getting both people results and giving counties accurate data reports. So how is that impacting Orange County?
Yeah, there's a couple ways. One is it's making it a lot more difficult to do contact tracing because the counties is not getting the full lists of who's tested positive. So that's going to come in late, essentially, as they clear through the backlog, and it further hampers the contact tracing effort. It's also impacting schools. The state set up a waiver process to open up elementary schools sooner than the rest of the different types of schools if certain criteria are met. And a wave of local elementary schools in Orange County applied to seek permission to reopen. But that's all in limbo now because of these problems with the state's computer system that receives and reports out the test results. The system's called CalReady, and both state and county officials say there's been an undercount of confirmed cases into that system because of the tech problems. And for now, the state's health department has put a hold on any reopening waiver applications for elementary schools because of those data problems. It apparently doesn't affect hospitalization data, since that's separate systems that hospitals get test results and report them to the state through. But those CalReady problems are causing just a host of ripple effects. And for more on that, my colleague Spencer Custodio has a story on it at voiceofoc.org.
Any sense of how the current case numbers might differ from the actual real data?
Yeah, so what we're hearing from the county healthcare agency is that the backlog has created artificially low case numbers, particularly in the last couple of weeks, which they say it makes it very difficult to know critical data points like disease transmission rate and positivity rate. And what they're saying is that once the backlog gets cleared, the real numbers are actually higher. And so there'll be a kind of a retroactive increase for the last few weeks of the number of positive test results. How many of those, it's still unknown, and we'll have to keep an eye out and see what happens.
Talking to Nick Gerda with the Voice of OC. Now, another story your colleagues have been following around related to the pandemic is about the budget shortage facing Orange County's food stamp program, also known as CalFresh. What are some of the factors that are putting that program's future in jeopardy?
Yeah, my colleague Spencer has a story out today on how the Orange County Social Services Agency is facing a big budget shortfall that could mean major cuts to food stamps if county officials can't fill the gap. This is all happening as the economic fallout from the pandemic has pushed welfare needs to historic levels. They've had historic levels of requests for food assistance, welfare assistance, things of that nature as people are out of work. The social services director said the agency could lose up to $92 million for food stamps if the county can't put up its end of the funding. There's kind of a matching component that the county has to put in for this. And county officials say they're doing everything they can to try to ensure those food stamps are still funded. The county's going to hold its budget hearing on September 1st, where a lot of this is going to play out. And among the money-saving options they're looking at is cutting spending by offering early retirement programs for employees, And they're not currently looking at furloughs, but it could come. It's an option that's on the table for the future. And this is a challenge a lot of local governments are facing. Sales tax revenues have really plummeted during the pandemic, while demand for services has been soaring. So they're all kind of anxiously trying to figure out how to balance their books and make things work out financially going forward.
One more thing, Nick. Can you give us the latest on the investigation into evidence booking problems at the Orange County Sheriff's Department?
Yeah, so that it took a new turn last week. The actual sheriff of Orange County, Don Barnes, announced that the problems there were more widespread than previously known. He disclosed that there's 15 new criminal investigations of sheriff employees related to evidence booking. There's already two guilty pleas by sheriff's deputies for willfully failing to perform their official duties. One case, Deputy Bryce Simpson made false statements in 74 different police reports about whether evidence was booked. And that's according to a sheriff's investigation. So they say that of these 15 new investigations, criminal investigations, six have been referred to the DA's office for possible prosecution. And this all relates to a series of audits that the sheriff's department did and kind of kept a secret essentially for a couple of years that found widespread issues of sheriff's deputies booking evidence late, sometimes a month or more late, and in some cases making false statements in their reports about whether evidence was booked. So it's continuing to unfold and a lot of eyes on trying to figure out what happened there and what this all means.
That's Nick Gerda with the Voice of OC. Nick, as always, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Dave.
All right, moving on. More than 2,000 people in Los Angeles County who lived in nursing homes have died from the coronavirus. But at many facilities, residents weren't tested until months into the pandemic. And at one nursing home, testing happened in late May. As KPCC's LEU reports, family members are still grappling for answers.
Amilcar Jones was getting nervous. His 81-year-old mother was in a nursing home, and he hadn't seen her since March. He tried to stay calm throughout April. As far as he knew, there hadn't been any COVID-19 cases there yet.
So I was kind of like, okay, maybe she will be all right. But then when May came, it was just like, there's too much time. You know, it's too much time, too much room for error.
His mother hadn't been tested yet for the coronavirus, but he wanted to move her out before anything happened. His mother, Melvia, needed around-the-clock care since having a stroke and seizure, so he looked for nurses to hire and prepared to get her back home.
Like starting to redo her house. She lives not too far from here. And she still had a lot of stuff, so I was re-putting it, thinking of ways I can sanitize, trying to set it up for her to be there.
On May 20th, the nursing home Beverly West in Los Angeles started mass testing all of its residents and staff. There hadn't been reports of the virus yet, but outbreaks were raging in nursing homes around the county. Jones started worrying about his mother's condition. Her regular blood work started looking off, and she developed a cough.
So I wanted to get her sent to Kaiser, and they were kind of like, well, hold off, let's try giving her more water, let's try this and this and that, you know, when I would call.
About a week later, his mother started having trouble breathing. The nursing home sent her to the hospital down the street. The very next day, on May 27th, Jones got a call from the nursing home with the results of the coronavirus tests from the week before.
She was a newer nurse, and she told me, I just want to tell you the test results came back, and 13 residents have COVID, and your mom's one of them.
Hours later that day, he got another call from the hospital. His mother's heart had stopped.
I went that night. I just got in my car and started driving, and, you know, I went over to the hospital. And they let me in to see her. She was, you know, she was passed. She was still warm, you know, but they let me in to see her, and I just saw her, and I just talked to her and everything.
It was the last time he saw her. The nursing home Beverly West didn't respond to requests for comment for this story. Beverly West isn't the only facility that didn't have its residents and staff tested until months into the pandemic. Mike Dark is a staff attorney at the California Advocates for Nursing Home Reform.
It's inexcusable that it took so long for county and state authorities to get their arms around the virus's spread in Los Angeles County facilities.
It wasn't until mid-June that LA County health officials announced that testing had been completed at all nursing homes. But Dark says by then it was too late.
We know that residents of those facilities are extremely vulnerable to the virus, there is no reason why this should have taken so long.
LA County health officials say there were a number of factors for the delays. One, testing was limited early in the pandemic, and that testing at skilled nursing facilities was, quote, one of the many priorities public health had during that time. But Jones, who didn't have symptoms, was able to get a test from a city site 3 days after his mother did. He got his results first. He's still frustrated that testing for his mom, who is at higher risk, happened so slowly.
My thought is like, you know, a lot of people, I know people that passed away in April in nursing facilities. So I don't know how they couldn't have safety netted it by May.
Of all the deaths in LA County from COVID-19 so far, more than 40% have been of people who lived in nursing homes, including Jones's mom.
She was one of the most honest, caring people. You know, people say that about everybody who dies, but my mom was really that lady. I miss her. I miss her, you know. I miss her a lot.
At Beverly West, around 90 staff members and residents got COVID-19. At least 16 people have died. Jones and his family held a funeral for his mom in early June. I'm Ellie Yu.
All right, most of the world's population lives on land near the ocean. Now, picture a map of the globe, and a lot of the biggest cities are right on the water. New York, LA, Tokyo, Shanghai, Rio de Janeiro, the list is very long. That is why rapid land subsidence caused by sea level rise is such an important issue for the scientists who study it. Because 50 years from now, you might need a submarine to get to that beautiful dream California beach house. A research team at Arizona State University studied the state's 838-mile coastline from 2007 to 2018. And they used something called Interferometric Synthetic Aperture Radar, or INSAR. Glad they shortened that name, to see how much California's coast was rising and falling. And the news might leave you with a sinking feeling. Pardon the pun, or don't pardon it, it's up to you. Starting up north in Monterey Bay, including the city of Santa Cruz, it tops the list with a subsidence rate of nearly 9 millimeters per year. San Francisco Bay is dropping at just under 6 millimeters every year. San Francisco Airport, 2 per year. And as far as LA, researchers wrote, quote, the area shows subsidence along small coastal zones. Most of the subsidence, though, is occurring inland. Now, if you're wondering how land subsidence happens, generally two ways. Naturally, as in tectonics, the Earth's crust moving along with the ebb and flow of the oceans, moving sediment around. And then, of course, it's on us, you and me, humans, extracting groundwater and oil, as well as gas production. So I wouldn't blame you if you wanted to trade in the dream of a Malibu beach house for a palm desert hideaway instead. All right, even though they might not be shown on TV as often, the protests have not stopped since George Floyd died May 25th. Groups demanding action on social justice are still making the same demands. And coming up, we'll hear from the Black Student Assembly at USC calling on the university to reimagine public safety. That's next when Take 2 continues.
You keep saying you got something for me, something you call love, but confess, you've been a messin' where you shouldn't have been a messin', and now someone else is getting all your best. These boots are made for walking, and that's just what they'll do. One of these days, these boots are gonna walk all over you.
Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC and streaming on kpcc.org. I'm E. Martinez. As conversations over racial inequality continue across the country, students at the University of Southern California are calling for anti-racism reforms on their campus. USC's Black Student Assembly has been one of the groups at the forefront of these efforts, asking that the university defund and demilitarize its Department of Public Safety, or DPS, among other things. In response, USC President Carol Folt has presented a series of actions to, quote, confront anti-blackness and systemic racism at the university, including a community advisory board to oversee the school's Department of Public Safety, making bias training mandatory, and creating a task force to address issues concerning race. Some students, though, say these reforms do not go far enough. Jaya Hinton is one of the co-directors of the Black Student Assembly at USC, and when we spoke, she told us about what led the BSA to organize.
Around the time the protests broke out for George Floyd's murder, we realized that we hadn't heard anything from the university. And at the same time, my co-director and I realized that we were some of the people who were meant to make a statement and help support our own community, that being the Black student community at USC. And so the first thing we did was release a statement to our fellow Black Trojans, just one of support. We hadn't established any demands yet. We just wanted them to know that we were here if they needed to talk, that we would do everything in our power to make sure USC felt safe for them, and that if there was anything they needed from us or from the school, we would be there to advocate for them.
You know, we've been seeing students across the country using Instagram to voice personal experiences with race. And I know that USC has one of those accounts called Black at USC. It has over 13,000 followers. How much of a role did stories told there play in organizing efforts with the Black Student Assembly?
You know, it's really interesting because that account came after we started organizing. But it's been one of the most powerful tools for advocacy. It was the easiest to incite that need for change in our students. And in this process, students started realizing that other students were a major part of the problem, which to some degree we knew, but realizing that the students in power were perpetuating some of these problems, whether it was intentional or not, made holding a position of power as a Black student at USC not the most welcoming environment. And it stopped a lot of students for applying for those roles. So at that point, we realized that this advocacy needed to occur at multiple levels, the student level, staff and faculty level, through DPS and through higher administration.
Now, changing the makeup of the Department of Public Safety, or DPS, is one of the demands of the Black Student Assembly. Can you tell us what changes the BSA is looking to make and how that would address the issues of race on campus?
So throughout history, police have been a source of fear and rooted in hatred toward Black people. And so because of that, changing the makeup of that police department, and that doesn't mean bringing in more Black officers. We don't need people like us to do the terrorizing. It means putting those funds, I believe the DPS budget is somewhere in between $40 and $50 million. And they have, I think, four officers who are meant to report to mental health calls or crises calls, instead of working with our student health center or working with our relationship and sexual violence prevention network to respond to calls where students are facing those very particular issues where they don't need someone with a gun coming up to them, but they need someone with empathy who can help them talk through whatever mental problem they're having, if there's a relationship problem they're having. And not even just through Black at USC, but with the Me Too movement and everything else that came up, you saw how a lot of police officers reacted to women in situations with sexual violence or domestic abuse, which is something that does occur very commonly on college campuses. And at USC, a lot of that is concentrated on the row, and our students don't even feel comfortable enough to go and report. So really, what does DPS do for us if no one's really investigating our problems?
Now, USC's President Carol Folt put forth actions to confront systemic racism on campus. Now, among these, we're creating a board made up of students, faculty, and others to help oversee the Department of Public Safety, and she sent updates to the community recently. Jaya, what are your thoughts on that? Is a good first step or not quite enough?
The thing about this community advisory board is that it's not a first step. They tried to put this in place years ago, and the board never convened. So with all the chances they had to use this board as a group that could do good, it wasn't acted on the first time. So I do find it hard to believe that it will be actually active or have any sort of power the second time around. And another thing that sort of rubs me the wrong way about it is that the students who have been on the front line of these conversations were not included in this process. And so it seems like a way to remove some of those more maybe radical voices, groups and students who are more driven toward radical change, to remove them from the equation. So it doesn't feel like enough.
Now, ultimately, President Carol Folt has laid out 8 steps that USC plans to take, things like making unconscious bias training mandatory to everyone at USC and working to hire a chief inclusion and diversity officer. Do those, Jaya, at least seem to be some good first steps?
I believe that the chief inclusion and diversity officer, as long as they are given a proper budget and staff, as long as they are receiving support from the administration, as long, and this is the most important thing to me, that they interface with students, they are responsive to students, that they don't just pass them off to whoever ends up sitting under them if they are able to hire a staff, right? Are you actually going to be putting in that time to talk to students, the people who are affected on a daily basis? All of those things are going to determine whether that person can make a difference at USC or whether they're a figurehead. So I'm still waiting to see. I have hope, and it seems that the administration is doing what they can, or at least that the search committee is doing what they can to hear out the students. And so I am happy about that.
One more thing, Jaya. USC in the last few years has had a rough run when it comes to campus culture from the administration, faculty, sports. I mean, it's been a tough time for USC's image right now. And Carol Folt kind of just got there. Wondering how much slack should she be given to try and turn around everything that students are demanding of her at the campus right now?
That's something that I've been saying since we started, right? Like, the majority of that administration is new. And so we can't place the past faults of other administrations onto them. However, for what does need to be addressed right now, she gets to choose what she prioritizes, right? Her administration gets to choose what they prioritize. So VKC not getting changed for 5 years, but getting changed within her first year here, that is something to commend her for. Having a group of students at the BSA level who she knew were working on unconscious bias training because she came to our first meeting, and then having a completely separate system without letting us even know, right? Even if she didn't consult us, without just telling us that faculty would be having their own training, letting us do that work and then not telling us, that was a decision that she and her administration made. You don't get slapped for that, but you do get slapped for what happened before you came. So that's kind of how I see it, right? What do you choose to prioritize?
Jaya Hinton is the co-director of the Black Student Assembly at the University of Southern California. Jaya, thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
One of the companies that has been able to survive and thrive during the pandemic is Netflix. People aren't going to the movie theaters, and the networks don't have any brand new TV shows to air. So that means anyone searching for something they haven't seen before is probably on a streaming service like Netflix. Coming up next, John Horn previews his podcast, Hollywood the Sequel, where he talks to the boss at Netflix, Ted Sarandos, and asks how he's handling his newfound power and responsibility. That's coming up when Take Two continues. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC and on the Take Two podcast, which you can find on Apple Podcasts. I'm E. Martinez. One company that is booming during this pandemic is Netflix. And this week on the LA Studios podcast, Hollywood, the sequel, John Horn talks with Ted Sarandos, Chief Content Officer and co-CEO of Netflix. John joins us now for a preview of his latest episode. What's up, John?
Hey, eh?
All right, now you've had a lot of writers, directors, actors on your podcast. This week, though, is a little bit different. Ted Sarandos is maybe the highest level executive you have on the podcast so far. Now, does he actually green light projects? Does he travel to festivals and say, okay, I want this, I want that, I want the other thing?
He says he doesn't make the ultimate decisions, that he has a lot of staff below him that make those decisions autonomously. But yes, Ted is at festivals, he's at screenings, he is at premieres. He has, you know, obviously a huge say in the direction of the company. And he says that most of the decision making about what they're going to make, could it be a documentary, could it be a local language production that's produced overseas, could it be a new series, is made by deputies. And if you look at those deputies, they obviously have a really good track record in terms of picking what series and movies they're going to make.
Yeah, you hire good people and you let them make these decisions for you. Now, on the podcast, you say that Hollywood is broken, but I got to think that Sarandos might not think it's broken because Netflix is really flourishing right now. So what does he say about the idea of Hollywood being broken?
Well, he doesn't think anything at Netflix is really broken, and obviously they've done tremendously well, and it sounds really difficult to say it, but in some ways the pandemic is maybe the best thing that happened to Netflix because you have a lot of people who are at home, you have movie theaters that are closed, and in the first two quarters of this year, Netflix has added 26 million subscribers, which was way beyond projections before the pandemic hit. And not only that, but they seem to be connecting on a very different level. People are checking out some strange shows like Floor is Lava. They're breaking through on series like Unorthodox. They've got a very interesting mix of content. And as eclectic as that content might be, people are responding to it. And they did really well in the Emmy nominations, getting the most nominations ever. But what's really noticeable is they got it from 52 different programs, including Tiger King, which got a nomination somehow.
I will admit, John Horn, that I have watched The Floor is Lava. I gave it a couple of episodes. It was fun while it...
I gave it about half an episode.
I wanted to see if they could get to the other side. It's basically a show about a group of people that go from one side to the other, and they can't fall into the lava. It's not actual lava. They're still alive after the experience. Now, John, in what way has the pandemic maybe allowed Netflix to address the brokenness that he sees, or is it allowing it?
Well, one of the things that Netflix has done, because they shoot all over the world, is they have been able, under their rules, to figure out places that are safe to shoot. So LA County right now, even if Film LA says that production might be starting up or ramping back up, it really isn't material. So Netflix for months has been shooting around the world in Iceland, South Korea, and Sweden. But here's what Ted says about how they have worked under the new rules.
The shoots are more organized. People know where they're supposed to be. They actually run quite smoothly. All the extra steps that is going into making the production environment cleaner and healthier actually doesn't result in a big delay of time, because of the efficiency of the production schedules.
Netflix says they follow very closely whatever protocols are in place in the country where they're filming. Now, if you're filming in South Korea or Iceland, you're pretty much safe anyway. If you're filming in Sweden, you have to take extra steps, which might include isolating the cast and crew, basically kind of creating an NBA-like bubble around the filmmakers. And that has worked. They haven't reported any outbreaks, and they are able to make shows. And the other thing that Netflix does, because so many of their programs have to be subtitled into different languages, is they work well ahead of TV networks in terms of production. So if you are a network and there wasn't a pandemic, let's say it's NBC, if you are shooting an episode right now, that episode might be on broadcast in 2 weeks. If Netflix is shooting an episode now, it's not going to be on until 2021. So in some ways, because they work so far in advance, they say they're going to have content through next year, and a lot of networks don't have that luxury right now.
We're talking to John Horn. He's the host of the LAS Studios podcast, Hollywood, the sequel. Now, on the subject of equity and inclusion, what does Netflix's boss, Ted Sarandos, say?
Well, one of our earlier guests, Ava DuVernay, said, and she has a deal at Netflix, said that as long as white men are in charge, nothing really material is going to happen. You really have to kind of tear the town down and rebuild it to have true representation and equity. And the three people who are at the top of Netflix are all white men, Reed Hastings, Ted Sarandos, and Greg Peters. So we asked Ted about that, whether or not three white guys running a company like Netflix can really be inclusive and really make sure that they are listening to other voices rather than their own.
Well, Ava also said in the New York Times that Netflix is the largest distributor of black images in the world. We have a deep commitment to diversity and inclusion, and we're getting better and more representative about it all the time. So I think that if all of the decision making authority was wrangled with myself or even the three of us, that would be a problem. But it certainly is not. And like I said, projects find their home on Netflix because of the diverse and rich group of executives who hear those stories and inbound those stories.
And I think it's important to note, too, that if you look at some of the content that Netflix is creating, I mean, they have deals with people like Ava DuVernay, with Kenya Barris, Janet Mock. These are all people who have been on the podcast. And so they're really intentional about making sure that they have a diverse group of filmmakers working for the company, and they have been for years. So if you look at the Netflix homepage, they also curate, you know, stories that are made by female filmmakers, stories about black stories. So they're really good about not only hiring those people, but also promoting their content. And it might just be me, but when I open my Netflix homepage, I do get a pretty diverse list of content that they think I should check out.
John Horn is the host of the LA Studios podcast, Hollywood the Sequel. Latest episode comes out tomorrow, and you can get it on Apple Podcasts or wherever you like to listen. John, thanks a lot.
My pleasure. Thanks, A.
All right, and while you're finding Hollywood the Sequel or any of our other great podcasts put out by LA Studios, you got California City, you got California Love, there's a million of them there. Why don't you find out and look for us, Take Two. You can listen to today's show, last week's shows, any show you want. We will be there waiting to be heard by you. So just go wherever you get your podcast. We're also all over social media. We're on Twitter, at Take Two. That's at Take Two. I'm there as well, at A Martinez LA. That's at A Martinez LA, and that is good for both Twitter and Instagram for your social media convenience. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take Two. We'll be back tomorrow at 2. Talk to you then.